This is Kevin Conroy, and you're listening to The Drift Space.
Initiating neural magic in 3, 2, 1.
We should probably do those movies with you.
Of course.
I'm gonna slide in. Miss McLean. How wonderful to meet your acquaintance. Oh, we're recording.
I wanted to catch some of the banter.
Oh, we're recording.
Well, welcome back to the Drift Space, ladies and gentlemen. We are not talking about Die Hard, but we probably will at some point. I am totally caught off guard. Today, Rebecca, GJ, and Dave decided to continue to say they're sorry by letting me host again.
Yay!
We're covering one of my favorite movies of all time. Probably the most cinematic masterpiece and quintessential nerd movie of all time, Back to the Future. And if you don't know the plot to Back to the Future, what are you doing with your life? Why am I even bothering with you? We can't be friends. Go.
Wow.
I mean, he's not wrong.
That's...
Anybody who doesn't know Back to the Future by now is just, well, not your friend.
I was just so anticlimactic. They're just not your friend.
You can dance if you want to. You can leave your friends behind, but if they don't know Back to the Future, well, then they're friends of mine. So
this has been the Drift Space.
The premise of Back to the Future is Marty McFly has a friend, Doc Brown, and in an experiment of time travel with a DeLorean, because what else does one use? Marty gets trapped in
1955.
Of course. And instead of the events falling through that led to his parents falling in love, he gets trapped in the middle. His mother gets the Florence Nightingale effect. And we find out that, well, if Marty doesn't fix it, he disappears forever. So, we talk about movies that, you mentioned that you ran the VHS out of Batman. Mm-hmm. Well, this is the first movie that I remember. Like, literally, I could have watched anything, but this is the first movie I remember. And I was the same way. I ran this video out until it would skip, like, every 2 seconds. And on top of that, I'm going to date myself even more. I got it when McDonald's was handing out classic videos. Like, instead of the commemorative cups and stuff like that, they were handing out classic movies. And this is how I was introduced to Back to the Future.
McDonald's always handed out some really solid swag back in the day.
Back in the day. They did. Yeah.
My favorite was the Batman Returns cups. 92. That was good. But also, I'm G.
Oh, and I'm Dave.
I'm sorry. I just got so excited.
And I'm Rebecca, and I figured, what the hell? Wow.
Okay.
All right. So, before I just gush all over this movie, I want to hear y'all's thoughts because this is a movie that. A phrase I haven't used in very long is near and dear to my heart.
Ooh.
My name's Dave, and I'm here to lose friends today.
Oh, wow.
Oh, no.
Oh, Dave.
No.
Not you.
Oh.
So, let me just put it on Front Street right here. I'm not crazy about the Back to the Future franchise. And I'm well aware that I'm in the minority of everyone that has ever watched anything ever. So I think it's appropriate for me to actually start by giving credit where credit's due, because I know it's a great movie. There are a lot of things that work really well for it, and I just want to kind of call those out. First, it's a beautifully shot film. The narrative flows almost flawlessly. The talent, top-notch. But one of the most remarkable things about Back to the Future is the way that it navigates exposition, which there's a lot of. It's a time travel type flick. So you get a lot of that exposition in there. But you put that exposition behind the theatrics of Christopher Lloyd and encapsulate that in a classic, fun, campy yet heartfelt 80s vibe. You get something that works really, really well. An example of that is like when anything Doc does, right? When Doc is going over the plan, he's simultaneously explaining what's going on, and it gives it that Ocean's 11 / heist feel, and like, here's how the time machine works, what the plan is, that kind of thing. And it naturally just builds really well into the story and transitions exceptionally well into the clock tower climax sequence, where we have very little dialogue, yet somehow we don't get lost there. And for me, that's a testament to a nearly flawless symphony of the writing, direction, and talent. That being said, as I kind of started with here, Back to the Future just doesn't do a whole lot for me, and I never really cared to revisit it. I've seen it a couple times in my life, but for me, if I'm going to watch a time-traveling franchise where the goal is to protect the future, it's Terminator. So to sum it all up, I view Back to the Future as like the Beatles of movies for me. It's classic, influential, and I have a high degree of respect for it. But I can't tell you the last time that I threw Beatles on my Spotify playlist.
Good night, everybody.
So this podcast may not include Dave from here on out.
I gave it a lot of credit. It just doesn't do much for me. I know it's great.
Well, okay, let's. I kind of want to mine this a little bit, because maybe there's something in there we can talk about. And starting with the Marty character, and this is something I wanted to explore in this podcast a little bit. It has been said repeatedly that Marty McFly is not a traditional hero in a movie, and that he doesn't really go through his own arc, and that he doesn't really learn anything by the end of his experience. Like he's in the exact same place he was before he went back in time. While I agree with that aspect, I don't think we have a character who wants nothing. Obviously, he wants to go back to the future. Okay. Obviously, he wants to make sure his parents get together. His goal is never to improve their lives, but although he inadvertently does. But what makes Marty McFly so non-traditional? And why is it that he works in spite of the fact that he doesn't learn anything by the tail end? Or does he? Is this one of the things that kind of turns Dave off, for example?
It's hard for me to look at this franchise as one single movie, because they always have the to be continued. Yes, he doesn't learn his lesson in this movie, but you know, later on, down the road, we do see the character development come.
Okay.
But in this one, because I don't think they actually planned on it being a trilogy. The movie just made so much that they're like, well, let's keep rolling with this. Let's keep seeing what we can do. But I think...
Exactly.
I think what makes Marty so relatable in this movie is that he's literally just caught in the middle of it. You know, I was going to bring this up much later, but season 2 of the movies that made us just dropped literally like 2 or 3 days ago as of recording this. And episode one was Back to the Future. So immediately I sat down and watched it. And Robert Zemeckis and all, I forget the other name, Bob Greer, I think.
Bob Gale.
Gale.
Bob Gale, thank you. They were talking about this, and I think it was Gale who went down and revisited his hometown, and he looked into his dad's yearbook and found out that his dad was president of some kind of chess club or something like that. And he literally thought to himself, he goes, would I have been friends with my dad? Because they ended up going to the exact same high school, just like 30 years apart. So he kind of looked at that and went, okay, yeah, it would be nice to see what my high school was like back then through Time Capsule, but would I have been friends with my dad? Because he was such a nerd. And then that's what struck him. He's like, what if? Let's roll with this ball. So I think that's what makes Marty a relatable character. It's like, would I have been friends with my parents?
I want to jump into this. I disagree with GJMJR that Marty has not learned anything. I think he's learned a great deal, and I definitely disagree with Dave for
everything.
Well, you know. Yeah. Oh, can,
look how shocked I am.
Now, Dave, I'm not here to convert you or anything, even though you're completely wrong. But I do want to go back to the whole Marty not learning everything during his time. I think he has learned something, because time is a basic premise for Back to the Future, obviously. But I also think that reconnection plays a bigger part, too. In Marty's original timeline, everything was so distant and empty. Even his family's relationship looked very disconnected and unbalanced. George is a pushover and a doormat. Lorraine is a strict religious woman who secretly drinks alcohol to cover up her frustration. His sister has never been with a boy because her mother never allowed her to be. And his brother is a pizza delivery guy. And not to mention Biff, George's a-hole boss, crashing George's car and barging into his home like he owns the place. Everything Marty was living in just seemed empty and hopeless. But it was during when he was in an era where his parents were complete strangers to each other that Marty begins to reconnect with his father, learning that George has a creative talent for writing science fiction but fears rejection, a common trait they both shared. He learns that his mother wasn't as conservative as he was made to believe. Turns out his mother was rather a bit of a free spirit, and there was even a deleted scene where Marty catches his mother cheating on a test, and Marty even reconnects with Doc Brown shortly after seeing him get shot to death by Libyan terrorists. Can you imagine that kind of emotions running through your mind, watching your mentor slash boss get killed in front of you, but seeing him again alive 30 years younger? If I had the ability to go back time and see my grandparents again, I would not stop crying. So I would be right there with Marty and doing everything in my power to keep Doc Brown from getting killed in the future and saving at least one life if I could. And then it dawned on me when Doc was reiterating to Marty on what to do to get back home moments away from the thunderstrike, the one line that put my mind at ease in the midst of all the chaos, he said, "Everything will be fine." I put that line and what I kept repeating in my head when the cord got disconnected and Doc had to climb up the tower. And every time that scene goes on, I keep saying, "There's still time. There's still time. You can do it." So I put together what I kept repeating in my head to Doc's line, "Everything will be fine. There's still time." It occurred to me that maybe this film in particular that really spoke to me, that there is always time to go back and reconnect with your loved ones, no matter where you are in life or time. And Doc's words came true. Everything was fine. Better than fine. Marty's house was cleaner, nicer. His brother worked at an office. His sister had two boyfriends, and his mother and father were more relaxed, confident, and just as in love with each other. Since the day George KO'd Biff, it was real love. It wasn't out of pity. Not to mention George became a novel writer. All of this happened because their own son took the time, both literally and figuratively, to listen and learn from his parents at the same age range as Marty's. And it was Doc Brown who said, everything will be fine. But it was Marty McFly who said, everything is great. And so is this movie.
Rebecca, I'm going to have to disagree with you there. I do not believe that Marty had any character development within this movie. He just brought out the better side of his parents. That doesn't mean he actually changed himself. He learned to help his parents become better people. And the line Doc says, everything will be fine. Well, you know, past Doc doesn't know that future Doc dies. He's just referring to the timeline will be as it should be. But I mean, I'm not saying everything you said wasn't like a beautiful sentiment. I'm just saying, as far as character development for Marty goes, I think there was none.
I think it's interesting because there's things to take away from both of your points of view. Rebecca, what you're talking about, there's a lot of merit to what you're talking about, but I also think there's a lot there that Marty doesn't necessarily learn. It just happens. Everything will be fine. Everything's great. Is more of a statement of truth than something that happened to Marty, that happened within Marty's self and arc. And Jared, where I agree that perhaps he's not exactly in a different place. I mean, you know, he's let me rephrase that. By the end of the movie, he's
at a different time.
He's at the same place, same time, different atmosphere, I guess. But his character isn't in a different place. I do think to say that he learned absolutely nothing might be a bit of a stretch, because he at least, you know, learned more about his parents when they were growing up. He at least learned more about Doc when they were growing up. Is that something that, you know, really affected his character arc or development for that matter? No, but it's something that he did learn and now has that information by the end of the movie. He was this journeyman that took us on this journey to kind of look at these, honestly, on paper, more interesting supporting characters. The fact that Marty holds my attention as well as he does, I think, is a testament to Michael J. Fox and his performance and what Robert Zemeckis got out of him. And I also kind of wonder now, you know, what if Eric Stoltz, who played Marty for the first, 4 weeks of shooting, would this movie have been as effective?
Mm-mm. I don't think it would have.
Well, in that,
I don't think so.
Documentary, they actually said Eric played that, you know, whereas you got Christopher Lloyd, you know, and everybody else hitting the comical beats, Eric was kind of like taking this seriously, as in like,
yeah, Eric stopped.
Like, I actually had a trial back in time. This is bad juju.
And yeah, Stoltz didn't have the comedic timing that the other characters had, apparently. And
yeah, Stoltz was more of a method actor, a drama.
Uh-huh. And you know, I've read Stoltz actually went back in time for this part so he could really portray it realistically. It's a shame he wasn't used, but his comedic timing with Christopher Lloyd, especially, who is the most important character for him to bounce off of, just wasn't there. And, you know, we talk about Marty on paper not having this massive developmental arc. What would we have thought of this movie? What would we have thought of Marty had it not been Michael J. Fox?
Right. Yeah. You know,
I mean, would the flaws that, you know, a lot of people see on paper about the character have come to light? And or are they there even with Michael J. Fox? Is this something that, say, Dave has a problem with?
I don't have a problem with it.
Okay.
I think y'all are mistaking me not enjoying revisiting the movie with me thinking it's a crap movie, which I don't.
Okay.
I don't think that it is. I think that it's a great movie. I just don't enjoy revisiting it. I'm not a raving fan of Back to the Future just because it doesn't do a whole lot for me. That's all.
In that spirit though, you know, it is you know, why does it not do something for me? Does the character not work, or no. Is it other aspects?
No, the character works fine. I think it's just the for me, what doesn't work about it is somewhere in the execution where it just falls flat I wouldn't say falls flat, but it just doesn't, like, I have a really hard time explaining it.
I'm noticing by all the pauses.
Yeah, it's something that's kind of ineffable for me. Like, it's just not a movie that I enjoy going back to rewatch again and again and again. Like I said, I have a high degree of respect for it. It could be that I just never cared to go back and meet my parents when they were young. It could be that. We can chalk it up to that if we'd like. And I'm not saying, like, and I all jokes aside, like, I don't think this concept of going back in time to meet your parents has to be something that resonates with you specifically. I mean, what kid didn't want to, you know, go back in time in some capacity, whether it be to redo an embarrassing moment from school or, you know, make a different choice from earlier. I think that aspect is cool. And, you know, time traveling movies are pretty sick. Like I said, I love Terminator. Back to the Future just doesn't do it for me as well as others from a revisiting standpoint. It is a good movie, though. I can't really say much negative about it because there isn't a whole lot of negative things you can say about it.
Well, right. And here I am. I love the movie personally. And I think it's really an all-time great. I would even go so far as to say this is one of those rare, perfect scripts. This is not the blueprint for how I would suggest someone go about creating a perfect script. But I do think this is a perfect script, in large part because of one of the reasons you actually gave, Dave, was that the exposition, all the information we need to make the story work, is given in the first act. You know, nothing pops out of left field later on in the movie that's like, oh, here we go. We'll make it work by, you know, pushing this information into the movie. Everything we know early on in the movie is the information that pushes the film's story and solutions forward later on. There's never a deus machina or anything like that going on. It's quick exposition out, and then using that information to move forward. Despite how Marty McFly's character looks on paper, especially against all these other characters who really are written more traditionally, everything clicks, and everything clicks extremely well.
And just going back to the exposition piece again, I think that the way that they go about it, you know, covering it all in the first act and, you know, Christopher Lloyd's delivery of it, it allows you to really be in the moment later on, instead of like, oh, let's take a pause. Here's what's going on.
Right. Right.
Time out.
And that's the way movies should be. That's the way stories should be written. I feel like way too often in blockbusters these days, we have these kind of like stops, these pivots to explain something that just happened, or, you know, a writer really, really wanted to put a twist in there, but all it does is turn out to be kind of an exposition-y moment explaining how that twist works. And we don't get that here. We get just straight up character writing once all the information we need is out.
And I think speaking on the exposition, it's given in a very digestible way. It's very,
yes.
I don't want to say it's spoon fed to us, but it's very understandable. Even then, like, one of my favorite lines is like, Doc gives all the exposition, and he goes, "I remember all of this as far as I go back and see, pine trees." He had this crazy idea of breeding them.
And he does this little flinch after the fact. But it's a beat like that that makes us remember that line of dialogue, so that once Marty goes back in time and he runs into pine trees,
yeah,
we connect the dots. It's really brilliant.
I love the subtleness of the introduction, of introducing a character. And my favorite is probably the intro. There was no one in it. Just one full camera shot movement of clocks, an old frame newspaper segments of Doc Brown's family estate being burned down, and the inventions that automatically turn on the television of the news reporting stolen plutonium that's actually underneath Doc's bed. You are given a full introduction to Dr. Emmett Brown's character in the beginning of the film, and he's not even shown yet. And my second favorite character intro was a DeLorean. Yes, the DeLorean is a character in the movie, just like how the Enterprise is her own character in Star Trek, just like how Gypsy Danger is her in Pacific Rim, the USS Nathan James in The Last Ship, Megazord and Power Rangers, and don't get me started on the Gundams. I envy the people who first saw this when this premiered in theaters. When the theme was playing in the background, the trailer opens, and you see the expression on Marty's face as the DeLorean is first introduced, backing out from the trailer with steam and the camera, taking a good long panning moment before we're finally physically introduced to Doc Brown as he gets out of the car. Exquisite entrance on both accounts. Those are I love the subtleties. And like you said before, how you can connect the dots later on. I thought it was perfect writing in my case.
Aren't you glad that it was a DeLorean and not a refrigerator?
Oh my gosh, yes.
Well, you know who we have to thank for the beautifulness of that amazing DeLorean, right? One of our favorite production companies that we've been talking about for a very long time. ILM.
Was ILM? Okay.
It was ILM.
I read that they took a while in figuring out what kind of time machine they would use. Mm-hmm. I think they did mention a refrigerator, but scratch the idea out of fear that kids might get stuck inside the refrigerators and eventually.
Well, they also thought about, you know, a traditional like time tunnel as well.
Oh, I did not hear about that.
Just like
I forget what other car they said they were thinking about using.
They tried using a Ford Mustang, but to Dom Toretto's disappointment, they ended up using a DeLorean.
But if you're going to build a time machine, why not build it with some style?
I got that. By the way, I completely forgot that Alan Silvestri composed this.
How could you forget? Music.
Okay, and I want to bring this up. This is just one of the many things, the many miracles of the film. Spielberg, who produced the film, you know, it's funny. The screenplay was shopped just at about just every studio imaginable and turned down. And when it was finally scooped up, there were still ideas being brought up and shot down. Spielberg did not want Alan Silvestri to score this movie. He did not. No, he was not impressed with Silvestri's prior works. And he didn't think it was exciting enough for, you know, a big tentpole film. And so Zemeckis actually told Silvestri, hey, write this like a big action flick. Make it really, really big, even though it's mainly a drama. There's not really a ton of action, but make it sound like big and actiony just to impress Spielberg. And when Spielberg heard the main theme, which is now iconic, he was really impressed, and he decided, you know, Silvestri can have the job. We talk about, can you imagine this movie without Michael J. Fox? Can you imagine this movie without Alan Silvestri?
No. I mean,
and his themes.
No, I can't.
And to this day, it's still his best work.
Like you said,
and this is a guy who did the Avengers theme.
Yeah, no, like you said, this movie is a bunch of just puzzle pieces falling into place, and it just make it, every one of them just improves and enhances as far as you go along.
And that's what makes it so perfect. You know, we talk about there's no such thing as a bad actor or bad director is what we were told one time. There's only bad collaborations. And so Eric Stoltz, great actor, fantastic actor,
mm-hmm.
just not right for this movie, just not a great collaboration for this movie. Okay, so they let him go. They get Michael J. Fox. They reshoot, the shots that Stoltz was in, and do the rest with Fox. All right, and then you have Alan Silvestri. Who are they going to get with? But besides him, maybe John Williams. That would have been great. John Williams is fantastic. I'm sure he would have come up with an excellent score. But this score,
it clicks.
It's Back to the Future. It is Back to the Future. And it's odd because, Dave, you talked about the end of the film, how there's not much dialogue, but you know what there is plenty of? The music.
Yarp.
And the music is taking center stage and helping drive the action and the drama and the excitement. And the music sort of informs us when something exciting is happening or something bad is happening. Like when Doc is hanging off the clock tower, and he's, putting he's clicking the wires together. And one wire comes out. It's not enough that the visuals tell us that he unplugged one of them. You hear the music kind of take a downturn. And it just enhances the moment. It enhances the dread. It enhances everything about one of the finest climaxes of the 1980s, and I can't imagine this movie without Alan Silvestri. And also, I don't know, what Alan Silvestri's career would have been like had he not done this movie. I mean, could you? We probably wouldn't have stuff like The Avengers had he not had his big break with this film.
Talk about like all the great things about this movie. Let's talk about Crispin Glover for a minute. The monkey wrench in Back to the Future.
Well, what do you mean by monkey wrench?
Apparently, he was like, out of everything that they shot, they had difficulties with him and Zemeckis butting heads on set constantly.
Okay, yeah, I don't know too much about that story because of everything I've read that actually works. But what did transpire between them?
Well, Crispin was like, I don't feel my character would do this. Like, there are several shots, Rebecca was referring to the deleted scenes earlier. There are several shots where George McFly is just so flustered and just so, like, nerd eccentric that he keeps, like, moving out of the camera shots. And apparently, when I was watching the documentary, that was a huge thing. They're like, they kept saying, Zemeckis would be like, okay, this is your motivation. This is what you have to do. And Crispin would come back and be like, well, I disagree. I think, like, the scene where George is trying to talk to Lorraine for the first time in the diner, Zemeckis was like, all you have to do is open the door. And Glover was like, no, I don't think my character would open the door. So they compromised.
God.
It shows Michael J. Fox actually shoving him into the door. Like, it's just apparently in one scene, he would not sit still. So they literally built a barricade around him so he could not move.
Oh, I did. Yeah, I did hear about that. Yeah. All right. Yeah.
Which is why he was not invited back for part two, because he was such a wonderful man to work with.
Well, okay. We talk about how Crispin Glover was hard to work with. Let's talk about Thomas Wilson for a second here. How did this man's career not take off after not just this movie, but the other two as well?
Right?
He wears so many hats. What an incredible character actor. Rebecca, please.
Let me take this one.
All right.
Okay, so the actor Thomas Wilson, he's actually best known on being various other voiceover characters for SpongeBob SquarePants. If you ever hear any of the fish that screams "my leg," that's Biff. That's Biff screaming "my leg," and many other lines too. I find it hilarious to hear Biff's voice under the sea occasionally with SpongeBob. He's also a stand-up comedian and a painter, and I went on his website, and he actually paints. Biff has his own art gallery, and before you ask, no, none of them had any Back to the Future themes, which reminds me, I also read that he got so tired of explaining his character to people from Back to the Future that he started handing out print-up cards to people with answers of frequently asked questions, and even sang a song about it. I mean, look it up on YouTube. Biff sings. I kid you not. It's hilarious.
That's wonderful. But yeah, no, Biff is such an iconic villain. How did his career just not skyrocket?
What do you mean? He's on SpongeBob.
Seriously, he plays young Biff, old Biff, older Biff, and then Mad Dog Tannen.
Wasn't he also a regular on Freaks and Geeks? The show that started like everyone's career?
I think so.
I think he was.
We talked earlier about villains you love to hate. This is definitely one of those villains you love to hate.
Well, and I wonder if that's one reason why his career didn't take off. Maybe he was in danger of being typecast or was going to be typecast. It just blows my mind that someone with actors who can contort their face the way that Wilson does in this movie, he looks angry a lot of this. He's not quite as rubber-faced as, say, Jim Carrey, but I mean, good grief. His expressions, they stick with you. And in fact, outside of Christopher Lloyd's kind of like wide-eyed expressions, he's the next one I think of when I think of just this kind of like over-the-top acting. And it worked. Again, it was something that worked. He was very imposing. He delivered the lines exactly the way it needed to be delivered, which is another thing. I feel like everyone in this movie sort of delivers their lines and almost overacts their character a little bit to get a point across. This movie, it's just weird how it works sometimes, because does anyone feel that the gestures and the reactions from the actors are almost too big sometimes? Like, this wouldn't work in any other movie, but it's only because everyone is just so up high in their delivery that it all feels like it exists on that plane.
I see a lot of more of that from Christopher Lloyd as Doc Brown, the way he just moves around and talking to his younger self, talking to Marty, and then pointing at the camera saying, "We'll send you back to the future," which I think I heard was not the original writing.
No, but that was not the original line.
Yeah, but it worked not the perfectly.
But even then, you have stuff like Marty talking really loud over almost no one all the time, going, wait, Doc, are you telling me that my mom has the hots for me? You know, it just seems like it should be in an animated character.
So, counterpoint, I think more so than an animation production, I think it speaks to the 1950s, like, Broadway vibe. It presents as a stage play, almost.
I can buy that. Yeah.
That's the vibe that I get from it.
This is also Michael J. Fox's first big movie. I mean, he was literally moonlighting. He was shooting Family Ties in the day and shooting Back to the Future at night. So he wanted to, you know, he really wanted to be up there with the big dogs. I heard that when they approached him with the script, they literally just handed him an envelope, and he was holding it, and then he held like a Family Ties script next to it and just looked at it and goes, "Okay, I'll take the movie," without even reading it.
Well, I mean, are you going to say no to your first feature? It just, it's just done. Listen, the screenplay is fantastic. It is utterly incredible. Great lines of dialogue. We talked about the exposition, the way it carries the story forward and whatnot. But let's just say the script sucked. Were you still going to say no to I think one of the big holdouts, though, was Christopher Lloyd. He wasn't interested in it for a long time because he was working on his stage career for a time. But they just kept calling him back and calling him back and calling him back. And he actually did read the script, I believe, or one version of the script, I believe, and turned it down. And they still just kept pressing for him to do the movie, to do the role. And again, we have to ask the question, what would this movie have been like without Christopher Lloyd? I mean,
it would have sucked. I'm sorry. You can't do it without... It's got to be Michael J. Fox and Christopher Lloyd, okay? They have the best chemistry together. It makes so perfectly. They're almost like in complete synchronization for me when it comes to acting. I love Fox's... And especially Lloyd's facial expressions, his big wide eyes and line deliveries to each other from you made a time machine out of a DeLorean to 1.21 gigawatts to what the hell's a gigawatt to great Scott, this is heavy. That's that word again, heavy. Is in the future, is there something wrong with the Earth's gravitational pull? I could probably end this podcast right now by just reciting the whole movie line by line. It's so good.
So I have a question. If Christopher Lloyd was not available, who would you pick to stand in? I would submit Kelsey Grammer.
Was he old enough? Was Kelsey, was he doing Cheers?
I'm not taking point in time. I mean, it's a time traveling movie. Okay, we can play around with the time.
Oh, for God's sakes, Marty!
Marty, can I see you in the kitchen?
I think Kelsey Grammer's about as good as you can get on that one. I don't know why, and I don't take this suggestion seriously at all. But William Shatner would have probably been hilarious.
What does God need with a time machine?
With a DeLorean.
With a DeLorean.
Saturday night, we're sending you back to the future.
Yeah. Can you imagine that? 1.21 gigawatts. 1.21 gigawatts. Come on!
Scotty's down there in the engine. I'm giving her all she's got.
No, I think Kelsey Grammer is as good of a casting as any outside of Christopher Lloyd.
I can't think of anybody.
What about Patrick Stewart? No, he's too short.
120.21 gigawatts. Make it so.
What a different movie this would have been.
I mean, and this is what we've been talking about a lot of the time. This movie, somehow, JR mentioned puzzle pieces. This film managed to get all the right puzzle pieces to make it work. This movie without Lloyd or Fox, it almost didn't have Fox or Wilson. Silvestri almost didn't have Silvestri. It wouldn't have clicked like it does today. It was really almost a, oh, I'm going to get crap for this, lightning in a bottle moment, or lightning in a clock tower, I don't know. And it doesn't, you know, we almost didn't have the DeLorean either.
Yeah.
You know, a refrigerator? Come on. Or a time tunnel strapped to another car. And why not, you know, whoever it was who said, hey, simplify it. just make the car the time machine. Yes, absolutely. So yeah, and it, what's fascinating is that outside of Rebecca, I haven't really gone into a lot of like themes or narrative meaning from the movie. And I think Rebecca did nail it pretty well, probably way better than I would have dived into it. But I think what's fascinating is that it's not, you know, this is a movie that's not necessarily a message movie. It just is a very clever working film. You know, we go back to the discussion we've had before. Does a movie need to have a strong theme or a strong message in order to be good? And does it enhance that film's quality? But also, what happens when it doesn't have that? Is Back to the Future, for example, any less of a movie because of that?
I think it's perfect the way it is.
I mean, very technically, yeah. Very technically, yeah. I agree.
That's,
kinda,
that's a loaded question there, bro. I mean, I gotta do more research on that one.
Well, thanks. No, I don't think it's something that you have to necessarily do research for, but it is something that's worth kind of mulling over. What is Back to the Future trying to say, if anything, and if nothing, is it still a viable piece of cinema worth praising like we do?
I think yes, because it has two it has two completely different eras colliding, and I've always been fascinating with the concepts in movies where generations meet one another and collaborate. I mentioned how had the ability to go back in time. I would have loved to see my grandparents again, see my parents as my age, see what they were like. And I would love to see, it's history. It's basically a history lesson. Just going back and learning it, like Marty says, this was educational. And I thought it, personally, I thought it was.
All right. I completely disregarded that line. That's interesting. That's going to stick with me now, Rebecca. That's pretty good.
And I noticed that Marty learned a lot from his parents, but his parents learned a lot from him as well. Like the 50s learn from the 80s, and the 80s learn from the 50s, how his parents learned how to be more confident and open to their creativity. Of course, in Marty's way, that was introducing Johnny B. Goode to a high school dance in the 50s. It was also more like a victory dance for the both of the McFlymen, for George and Marty. At the beginning of the film, Principal Strickland, I guess is his name, told Marty that no McFly has ever amounted to anything, but you end up having both George and Marty, George in succeeding and beating Biff and winning the love of his life, and Marty succeeding in singing live on stage after Huey Lewis himself turned him down in the 80s for being too loud. That was a nice touch there, Zemeckis. but yeah, I feel like it's all one giant history lesson for Marty in a way. And I feel like that time traveling is a major history lesson. It's completely dangerous and unrealistic, but yes, I don't know what else to say. It's just, as Marty said, it was educational.
Well, luckily for us, there are two more movies for us to dive into, and I look forward to those, because Rebecca, you said you like history lessons. Well, wait until we get to the Wild West.
Exactly. I can't wait for that.
Nothing short of accurate, I'm sure.
Oh, of course. Okay, so we actually have some questions before we wrap up here. First one is from the Kaiju King 8. And that question is Rick Sanchez a better or worse role model for Morty than Doc Brown is for Marty?
Worse.
okay.
Worse. No, Doc Brown's lovable. I mean, he kind of messed up here or there, but he's lovable. He's likable. Rick Sanchez is toxic times 10.
Horrid.
Yeah, violent. Abusive.
Yes.
Second question comes from Jimmy from NASA. Why is time travel the most dangerous power in the universe?
Watch any season of The Flash. You're welcome.
I think... Yeah. No kidding. Jeez, Barry.
Stop making Flash points. And then our final question is from Nathan over at the Monster Island Film Vault. He asked, how is Doc Brown a missing regeneration of the Doctor from Doctor Who?
JR, what number would he have been?
Ooh, that's a good question.
Because all the later numbers are typically younger and more hip and...
Yeah, but he still kind of got the, like, ooh, maybe like 5.5? He's always asking, like, people if they want jelly bellies. I see him, like, that kind of crazy.
All right, new headcanon. He actually wasn't wearing a vest at the end of the movie. He just regenerated.
My God. This needs to be a thing now.
Okay, so here's my theory. Doctor Who takes place in England, right? And Back to the Future takes place in America. So maybe...
This is the American Doctor Who.
I don't know. Doc Brown is America's Time Lord.
American Time Lord. Moving on.
I guarantee you that comic is out there somewhere.
And we did see him regenerate in the second movie because he takes off his fake face.
That's right? Pretty nice.
There you go.
I'm sorry, I thought you wouldn't recognize me.
The DeLorean versus the TARDIS. Next time on The Drift Space.
Who wants to take a guess at our poorly pitched? GJ, was it you or was it with Dave?
Dave had it. And if you can't remember it, here it is. A guy is having an exceptionally bad day on the way to work.
Okay, I have two guesses, but...
Okay.
Spider-Man 2 or Fight Club?
Actually, Rebecca, that's not bad. I mean, it seems okay. Obvious, but we've done obvious before. I'm going with Falling Down.
You know, I'm going to go with one we've recorded already, The Fifth Element.
The correct answer was Falling Down.
Thank you.
Well done. I've got one.
Oh.
Alrighty. Okay.
A family squabble breaks out when his best friend's wife is kidnapped.
Poorly pitched. Okay.
Okay, so let's wrap this thing up with some fanboy 50s.
Alright.
Who wants to go first?
Anyone?
I'll go, I guess, sure.
Alright, Rebecca. On your mark. Get set.
I honestly don't know what to talk about other than the fact that I've just I've been using my time to draw some prints for the Power Rangers Stop and Pop convention. I also been reading a lot. I'm reading a book about the life and career of George C. Scott. Why? I don't know. I just am. It kind of got me thinking about it. Maybe somewhere down in the future, the Drift Space ought to review much older movies, like black and white movies, the classics. If we were to review old classics, what would you, the audience, suggest? Definitely Metropolis, for sure. Citizen Kane, without a doubt.
Ooh.
I like 12 Angry Men, and It's a Wonderful Life. These are just some ideas I'm throwing out. I don't know. What do you guys think? And I'm just trying to kill my time.
Burn start time. Talking about clouds time. Again. Shrubbery.
Shrubbery.
Well, we could talk about worthless French fries, shoestring noodles.
You could, or we could talk about Final Fantasy, Rebecca.
Holy cow. You have not finished that game yet, have you?
So who else wants to do 10x50? I'll time them.
Full circle.
I'll go.
I got you.
Oh my God.
All right.
Ready? Sit. Go.
So, yesterday, as of this recording, was the 50th anniversary of Godzilla vs. Hedorah, which is ironically one of Rebecca's
yes!
favorite Godzilla movies. And it got me thinking back to how I reviewed movies, how I got into a short career of critiquing movies and whatnot, and how it kind of inspired me to stop giving star ratings to movies that I reviewed. Because to this day, I still don't know what to fully think of the movie, but I'm enjoying the fact that the movie still makes me think. And I think that's the most important part about looking at movies, is talking about what they make us think about, how they make us think. And I'm glad that we here on the Drift Space do not give star ratings
time
at the end of our episodes. Boom. Snuck that in there.
If we were to give stars, though.
All in all, I give Back to the Future 5 stars.
No, no, Dave.
I'll go.
All right, dear. Are you ready?
Yeah.
On your mark, get set, go.
So, because I haven't had much of a life, I'm going to talk about my wife's life, because she has more of a life than I do right now. So I got her to start playing Metal Gear, actually. Oh, wow. She's playing Phantom Pain right now. Seems like she's enjoying it. I don't want to speak for her, but it seems like she's enjoying it. She also just finished playing Jedi Fallen Order.
Oh.
She played the whole game there, had a really grand old time playing that. And yeah, bank my time for when I actually have something to say about something that I did.
About 9 seconds left anyway. But interesting. She already finished the Star Wars game, because I feel like she took to Twitter not too long ago and was like, "I'm playing." Yeah.
Yeah. So this is like her week. Like, she has like a couple weeks off before like her classes start back. So it only took her 3 days to finish it. And so I gave her a game that would last much longer.
I have a question about your wife, though. When do you suspect she'll reach Super Saiyan 3?
3 days.
Oh, that's when she rises again.
And what are your thoughts about her going Super Saiyan 4?
this type of blonde she currently has is actually a transitionary color. So it's going to become another color later. This is like the intermediary step, because she had dark hair and she also had dye in it before. More to come.
Do you know the color?
I do.
Are you going to reveal to us on the dress face? What?
I don't know how to describe it, dude. I'm colorblind, okay? So,
is she
oh,
is she Super Saiyan Blue?
She is.
Is she Super Saiyan Rosé? Is she Ultra Instinct? Where are we?
yes.
Probably somewhere between Super Saiyan and Ultra Instinct.
Okay. All right.
Yeah. Cuz it's got like that Ultra Instinct kind of hair, like that silvery-ish looking.
Okay. All right.
But it's got a little bit of blonde to it as well. That's what the final color is.
This means she's done what Goku hasn't. She's actually merged Super Saiyan with Ultra Instinct.
Don't give it. Giving a Toriyama ideas.
I'm not winning any arguments anytime soon.
All right, JR, are you ready?
Yeah, I guess so.
All right, here we go. Set, go.
As of this recording, the final trailer for the Transformers Netflix show has come out. And holy crap, it looks amazing. Because of that, I've been revisiting Beast Wars and then just enjoying the ever-loving crap out of that. And a friend introduced me to a game on Switch called Roomba First Blood. Will you play as a Roomba where people break into your house and try to steal stuff? You have to find a way to kill them and then clean up the mess before anybody knows that they are gone. It's definitely fun. It's definitely hard. But it's definitely bloody.
Time.
So this is like Home Alone meets Rambo.
As a Roomba.
As a Roomba, okay.
As a Roomba.
So like a really dark, brave little toaster.
The art style actually reminds me of Brave Little Toaster. But like when the people are in the house, it plays this really dark and really intense music. And then when you take everybody out, it's like, okay, time to clean. And it's like this happy little do-do-do-do-do.
Just cleaning up all the blood and guts while this
pretty much
happy tune. Oh my god!
I want this. I want this to be the next Little Biscuit.
Little Roomba.
Oh man!
No, Little Biscuit, just cleaning up everything. Oh my gosh! I don't have a towel. Good thing I'm a biscuit. I can just soak up all the blood.
Somebody opens the door. He's just bright red.
I didn't know you were going to be hungry.
This is jelly. This is jelly.
What's the line from Tony Stark?
Strawberry color.
Let's face it. Is it the worst thing you've seen me doing?
This is not the worst thing you caught me doing.
Well, thank you so much for joining us on our discussion on Back to the Future. If you like that, hang tight. Parts 2 and 3 are coming. I am JR. If you liked my ramblings, you can find me over there on Twitter at littleman_says1. And I also do cosplays at littlemancosplay.
And I'm Dave. If you care to hear any more of my unpopular opinions, I do another podcast with my wife called Pizza and Parsecs. And you can check us out on pizzaandparsecs.com.
And I'm G. If you want to hear my correct opinions, I'm on Twitter, G-Man of Mysterio.
There it is.
And you can check out my recently updated Substack, Deferential Wrath of a Rusting Markalite Cannon, at markalite.substack.com.
And I'm Rebecca. If you just want to see pretty pictures and not hear me talk at all, you can find me on the Linktree app, linktr.ee/reb.hudge. Commissions are still open.
And we are the Drift Space. Take a look at our show on bit.ly/TDS links. I said it all in one take that time.
I'm not cutting that out. Or actually, you're editing this one. Remember?
I'm leaving that in. Yeah. If you dug this episode, make sure you share it with a friend. Repost, retweet, and rewind us. You can also say hello at all our socials. We always say hi back. We'd love to hear from you. And as always, my friends, stay strapped. That's the power of love!